Good morning. My name is Regina, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Weatherford International First Quarter 2014 Earnings Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during that time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. We ask that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up, then reenter the queue for any additional questions that you may have. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, today's call is being recorded. Thank you. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Bernard Locraft, Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer. Sir, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. We will go through the same structure as we did last time, which is Krishna will say a few words, Dharmesh will, then I will speak, then open it to questions afterwards. Krishna, why don't you get started?
Thank you, Bernard, and good morning, everyone. I would like to remind our audience that some of today's comments may include forward-looking statements reflecting Weatherford's views about future events and the potential impact on performance. These matters involve risks and uncertainties that could impact operations and financial results and cause our actual results to materially differ from our forward-looking statements. Our comments include non-GAAP financial measures. Reconciliations to the most directly comparable GAAP financial measures are included in our first quarter press release. My comments are going to address the first quarter of 2014 and then the outlook for 2014. Reported net loss on a GAAP basis for the first quarter of 2014 was $41 million, or $0.05 per diluted share. After-tax charges for the first quarter were $140 million, which included $71 million of severance and exit costs related to a workforce reduction and the shutdown of loss-making operating locations in certain markets, $47 million associated with our legacy lump sum contracts in Iraq, principally the Zubair EPF contract, $22 million of professional fees and other costs largely associated with our divestiture program, year-end income tax material weakness remediation, and our previously announced redomestication activities. This is the last quarter we will incur costs for the remediation of the income tax material weakness. Non-GAAP earnings per share for the first quarter before charges was $0.13. Revenue of $3.6 billion for the quarter was down 4% sequentially and 6% lower than the first quarter of 2013, reflecting mainly three issues: the impact of activity stoppages due to unusually severe winter weather conditions in Russia and on land in the United States, normal seasonal weather-related declines in the North Sea, China, and Australia, and reductions in activity in Latin America driven by our capital discipline actions in Venezuela and completion of certain projects in Mexico. Our core business revenue of $2.9 billion was down marginally by 3%, both sequentially and year-over-year. Our non-core business revenue of $678 million was down 9% sequentially and 19% lower year-over-year. In the first quarter, our operating margin before R&D and corporate expenses was 11.2%, an improvement of 115 basis points sequentially and flat versus the first quarter of 2013. International margins improved 278 basis points sequentially, mainly in Latin America, which was up 782 basis points, reflecting the end of legacy lower margin contracts in Mexico and a more profitable activity mix in Argentina and Brazil. Europe, Caspian, Russia, Sub-Saharan Africa margins improved 127 basis points, principally from Europe and Africa, more than offsetting a weather-related deterioration in Russia. Middle East, North Africa, Asia-Pacific margins improved by 80 basis points, with a recovery in Saudi Arabia more than offsetting seasonal weather declines in China and Australia. North America margins declined 129 basis points, reflecting severe winter weather-related activity stoppages in the U.S. on land more than offsetting a seasonal improvement in Canada. Underlying this overall margin of 11.2% for the quarter are a 15.1% margin for the core business and a negative 5.8% margin for the non-core businesses. The unusually severe winter weather conditions in Russia and the U.S. impacted first quarter earnings per share by approximately 4 cents. Added to that was the impact of currency movements of 1 cent. The beneficial impact of cost reductions on the quarter was 1 cent. The tax rate in the first quarter was 28%. This was in line with expectations. Moving on to cash flow now. During the first quarter, our free cash flow from operations was a negative $439 million, and our net debt increased by $673 million, close to our expectations. Some of the key cash items were one-off in nature and include the payment of $253 million to settle the FCPA sanctioned countries' investigations and $60 million of cash severance and restructuring costs. While we will continue to incur cash severance and restructuring costs over the next two quarters, these amounts will reduce over time. Working capital balances rose seasonally by $284 million with reasonable increases in both accounts receivable and inventory balances, reflecting higher revenues in March, with DSO up 4 days, and day sales inventory up 2 days, coupled with a reduction in accounts payable to secure better terms from suppliers. CapEx was contained at $286 million, or just under 8% of revenue, in line with our previous guidance. Moving on to the cost reduction efforts, there has been an impressive focus on reducing our cost base. To date, we have already identified 6,632 positions for elimination, which is expected to realize $456 million of pre-tax savings on an annualized basis. Of this number, 4,307 positions, or 65%, have been eliminated already. We expect to conclude the bulk of the cost reduction program by the end of the second quarter. In addition, actions to shut down 20 loss-making operating locations began in the first quarter, with another 30 such operating locations slated for closure in the second quarter. Now moving on to the outlook for the second quarter and the year. The second quarter of 2014 will see an increase in revenue in all regions with the exception of the seasonal slowdown in Canada. Revenue growth will be driven by market activity and contract wins. Coupled with our cost reduction efforts, these improvements should allow us to improve our reported second quarter earnings per share to between 21 cents and 23 cents per share. We expect to see a significant pickup in activity in the second half of the year based on contractual wins, and Dharmesh will provide additional color in this regard later. We also fully expect that our management at all levels will complete the cost reduction efforts and refocus on growing the core business. Additionally, we will benefit from larger cost savings. The combination of market activity, contract wins, cost cuts, and the latest rolling forecast gives us confidence to reaffirm our most recent earnings guidance of between $1.10 and $1.20 per share for the year. This assumes a full year of contribution by both our core and non-core businesses, and we will change our estimates as the non-core business over the course of the year, assuming the earnings contributions of the divested businesses are material. This guidance includes about 30 cents from our cost savings actions, which will really become visible in our results from the second quarter onwards. 25 out of the 30 cent cost savings will come from the headcount reduction, with the rest coming from location shutdowns and other areas. Our tax rate for 2014 will range between 25% and 30% and will be dependent on the geographic mix of earnings. In 2014, we will continue the good work on capital discipline that began in 2013 and expect to generate $500 million in free cash flow from operations, with a recovery in working capital days after a seasonally challenged first quarter, and contained capital expenditure, which is forecasted to be $1.3 billion, or approximately 8% of revenue. Finally, let me give you an update on the status of our divestiture program. We have focused divestiture teams working on preparing data packages for each business. In March, we announced the signing of definitive agreements to sell the first of our non-core businesses, Pipeline and Specialty Services, for a total consideration of $250 million, including $241 million in cash and $9 million in retained working capital. We expect to close this transaction as soon as we obtain regulatory approvals. We have advanced well into the process of socializing with potential buyers the second of the four non-core businesses, namely the testing and production services businesses. The work streams for the other two business divestitures are on schedule, and we expect to complete these during the second half of the year. The work to carve out the land drilling rig business is also ongoing and on track for a first quarter 2015 IPO or spin. Coupled with these operating cash flow improvements and expected cash proceeds from our divestiture program, we expect net debt to reduce to $7 billion by the end of 2014, resulting in an improved debt-to-capitalization ratio of about 45%. With that, I now turn the call over to Dharmesh to comment on operations.
Thank you, Krishna, and good morning, everyone. The first quarter was a very constructive quarter and established a solid foundation that will drive revenue and earnings growth for the remainder of the year. Accomplishments for the quarter are as follows. Significant progress was made on the cost reduction initiative during the quarter. From an operations perspective, the focus was to increase efficiencies and reduce costs at the same time. We have standardized the support organization so that we have similar support structures in small, medium, and large countries. This will enable us to stay efficient as we grow again. The effort involved in eliminating 4,307 positions to date has been significant. The benefits will come in the quarters and years ahead. The other area of focus has been to identify locations where we do not have a competitive advantage and exit from some of the businesses in those locations. The exit of businesses from those locations will not only eliminate future losses, but will also allow the organization to increase intensity and focus on areas where we can grow our profitability. After a comprehensive review of our global service footprint, 50 such locations have been identified. Action to shut down 20 locations began in the first quarter, with the rest planned to be shut down in the second quarter. While these corrective actions will involve some one-time severance and restructuring costs, the end result will be a leaner and fitter company, better equipped to deliver revenue growth and better margins. And last but not the least, at the end of the first quarter, after a comprehensive review, we have one of the strongest pipelines of projects and contracts in recent times, and they span across almost every major region of the world. The resulting growth in the core segments will have a material impact on our profitability as the year progresses. Some details for each geographic area are as follows. The U.S. All core segments in the U.S. saw considerable progress in the first quarter, and the March exit rate for revenue and profitability was one of the strongest in recent history. The March exit rate was driven by an increase in activity and elimination of weather-related impact. We expect the run rate to get better as activity increases in the U.S. Our newest generation rotary steerable system delivered wells in record time for customers in three different shale basins. Based on technology, performance, and contracts awarded, commission evaluation is expected to show very strong growth for the remainder of the year. The repair of our pressure pumping business remains on track. We have more than 90% of our horsepower contracted and are on track to have all available horsepower under contract by mid-year. Artificial lift and completions also progressed well in the quarter and are expected to grow for the remainder of the year. Canada had a solid quarter, and performance was good despite the currency impact. Completions, formation evaluation, and artificial lift all did very well in Canada. Completions growth was driven by successful rollout of several new technologies for the thermal completions marketplace. In summary, North America will have a very strong year in 2014. Latin America. 2014 will be a transition year for Latin America for a number of well-known factors, and the first quarter performance was indicative of those factors. Having said that, the following improvements in Latin America are worth highlighting. Margins will be better in 2014 as we replace low margin or loss-making contracts with more profitable contracts. The total volume of work in existing contracts is in excess of $3.5 billion. Well construction and formation evaluation will have the best growth during 2014. Venezuela activity will continue, but at reduced levels as we are getting paid for products and services from the PDVSA joint ventures. Weatherford also has an extensive footprint in Argentina and will benefit from the increase in unconventional activity in Argentina. Although revenue will lag when compared to 2013, Latin America margins will continue to be better than what we had originally planned. Middle East, North Africa, and Asia Pacific. Despite seasonal factors, margin improvements were good in the first quarter and will continue to improve as we move into 2014. Primary factors driving margin improvements are as follows. Asia performance was good in the first quarter and will continue to improve as the year progresses due to new contract wins and implementation of well construction contracts won in 2013. The first quarter alone, we secured well construction contracts in excess of $100 million. Middle East and North Africa improvements will be driven primarily by the performance of the Gulf countries. During the first quarter, we completed two strategic technology projects in Gulf countries. The first successful commercial guide wave azimuthal resistivity geosteering well, and the first application of managed pressure drilling on a deep high pressure gas well. Both these projects have resulted in good commercial contracts. Gulf countries have a strong volume of contracts in all core segments, and revenues from the core segments in the fourth quarter of 2014 will be 40% higher when compared to the first quarter of 2014. Focused effort for Middle East will also be to exit loss-making locations, primarily North Africa and Iraq. During the first quarter, we exited 13 locations and will complete all location exits in the second quarter. In Iraq, we finished the last turnkey drilling project and also demobilized from the Garaf early production facility project during the first quarter. Our only remaining early production facility project, Zubair, is now 80% complete. We have $64 million in contingencies and over $250 million in potential claims from us still pending on the project. We are in active negotiations to bring resolution to all the potential claims on the project. While Asia performance has been solid, business performance has been challenged, primarily due to North Africa and Iraq. That will change this year. The combination of revenue growth from core businesses and elimination of losses from by exiting businesses will deliver a significant margin expansion in recent years. Europe, Caspian, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Russia. Revenue growth in this region will be driven by the following factors. Activity increases in the UK North Sea, coupled with delayed projects coming online, will result in higher revenue growth in Europe. 100% of our forecasted 2014 revenue is already contracted. Sub-Saharan Africa had the best quarter in history from a revenue and margin perspective. The first quarter was also a good quarter for new tender awards in Sub-Saharan Africa. During the first quarter alone, we have secured contracts in excess of $300 million across several product lines. Mobilization work for some of these contracts has already started, and revenues and profitability will increase as the year progresses. Russia revenue in the first quarter was significantly impacted by weather-related events and currency weakness. During the first quarter, we have seen a significant number of contract wins in stimulation and formation evaluation. Recent wins coupled with existing contracts in well construction, will drive revenue growth in quarters to come. In summary, strong revenue growth in the core segments will drive profitability in the region as the year progresses. Moving on to working capital, the first quarter working capital metrics are influenced by the seasonal trends that are typical of the first quarter of any year, with one exception. Inventory balances had the smallest growth in the first quarter when compared to prior years. As revenue increases in subsequent quarters, we will see a meaningful reduction in DSI as the year progresses. Capital efficiency remains a priority for the organization. The discipline around working capital and capital allocation will continue. What we accomplished in the first quarter is reflective of the Weatherford culture and indicative of what the organization can and will accomplish. Most of the heavy lifting related to cost cuts and exit of business locations is now behind us. For the remainder of the year, the entire operational organization will be focused on delivering the contracts we have secured and growing the core segments. This will allow us to deliver a material improvement in our margins and profitability in 2014 when compared to 2013. I will now turn the call over to Manoj.
Thank you, Dharmesh. If I add my own synthesis to the first quarter, I'd make the following comments. North America's quarter was lower than expected, in part for well-advertised weather issues. But weather wasn't the whole story. In our own Weatherford-specific dynamics, the employment reduction took place early in the quarter. This was very distracting until the process was over at quarter's end. Separate and distinct from weather and Weatherford dynamics, U.S. activity in January and February was asleep, for lack of a better term, and for no discernible reasons. The transition to March was all the more intense. Activity and our own successes rallied very strongly in March and have since gone from strength to strength. Our U.S. run rates in March exceeded all our expectations, a combination of self-help and strong market reaction. Latin America had lower revenues coming out of Mexico and Venezuela and much higher overall margins. A large contract with thin profitability was completed, lowering Mexico's revenues by about 30%, 3-0. The remaining business mix in Mexico had higher margins. Rising performance in Argentina is also to be credited for higher operating income. Eastern Hemisphere went through its seasonal low. It was very sharp in Russia and particularly low in the North Sea and some areas of Asia Pacific. The sharp seasonal downturn masked positive financial developments. As Dharmesh observed, we made progress in sub-Sahara Africa and to a degree in MENA. In fact, Q1 showed record financial results for SSA. Sub-Sahara Africa was very much of a factor at Weatherford. It is becoming one. Sequential margins for the Eastern Hemisphere rose from Q4 to Q1, which is encouraging. This reflects both our large headroom in the Eastern Hemisphere, given very low levels of margins coming out of 13, it also reflects the seeds of a financial turnaround in SSA and MENA. The global reduction in employment was implemented company-wide. Two-thirds of the reductions were done to date. By the end of Q2, this quarter we're in right now, essentially all employment reductions will be completed, and the process will be brought to a close. This will be in record time. If you peel through the cash movement in the quarter, in Q1, what will be apparent is continued progress in capital efficiency. Given strong seasonal trends in first quarters, the relevant analysis is Q1 13 on Q1 14. That comparison shows capital investments and inventories, the two most critical capital segments, with continued improved performance year on year. At the same time, we took down DPOs on payables, which is a necessary positive operating step in an environment of rising backlog. Our receivables rose more than in Q1 13. This reflected an unusually strong billing month in March. This is healthy, and the receivables will turn quickly into cash. The U.S. government settlement, severance cash payments, and the funding to completion of the last EPF contract all are also cash events in Q1. They were expected and are either behind us or have a short life remaining. Severance funding will be completed in Q2. Our EPF funding is essentially to year end, not beyond.
The last EPF contract with Uber has been a major distraction and a financial burden. It is a management and judgment error. It is almost over. We are progressing towards completion. We are at a specific 80% of project for completion. Progress on the ground in Q1 was measurable and tangibly visible. This is happening in a grindingly methodical process, but it is progressing nonetheless. We expect no or only transitional P&L movements on Zuber until completion of the project and the resolution of our potential variation order claims with our clients. We plan for quarterly cash expenditures in Q2, Q3, and Q4 to completion, similar to Q1, and followed by corresponding large cash inflow with payment of our invoices upon completion of the project. To reiterate prior announcements, Zuber will be the last EPF contract at Weatherford. We have not, and we will not, engage in any other turnkeys of any kind in southern Iraq. The terms of engagements for us have changed. Adding the various considerations above, Q1 was constructive and very busy. Our results were modestly ahead of first call estimates. Much was accomplished. This is all good. The level of profitability in Q1 is still too low. We must urgently drive a step change in our profitability. Our direction's objective is to accomplish this fast, be reliable, and sustainable. You know what our direction is. It is simple and won't change. It is summarized by three words: core, cost, cash. Core, we focus our product lines, well construction, formation evaluation, completion, and artificial lift. We divest of our non-core. We dedicate all our resources on people selection, people training, future technology development, asset-based commitments, and quality of execution. We grow our core. Our future growth will be strong, but disciplined and selective. We can achieve all three. Cost. Equate cost with the word efficiency. It isn't only reduction in workforce. It is quality of contracting and contract management all the way through to management of procurement. To calibrate the opportunity, we buy today in excess of $8 billion of production services. It is also the underlying logic behind our recommended domicile move from Switzerland to Ireland. It is all cost and efficiency driven. When you add the long-term pieces, there's room for large gains. We will pursue efficiency in all aspects of our business, operational, supply chain, financial, and administrative. We have low-hanging fruit to harvest. Arguably, we have fruit on the ground. Cash. Equate cash with the word returns. The cost of returns is central to our decisions, all our decisions. We will generate free cash flow each and every year. We will delever. Free cash flow is a key management metric driven by rising margins and capital efficiency. As we close all legacy issues, and we're close to having done that, performance will speak for itself. The combination of asset divestitures and our focus on creating a stronger, leaner company will produce a powerful and positive long-lasting effect on our balance sheet, will help drive a step change in our profitability. Nothing else. The direction won't change. The entire organization is committed. Performance-wise, I will reiterate what Krishna shared with you because we strongly believe it to be accurate. For this year, 2014, we believe the earnings outlook of the company to be in the $1.10 to $1.20 range. Free cash flow from operations to exceed $500 million. Our internal objectives target between $500 million to $1 billion in divestment proceeds by year end. The delevering, 13 on 14, must therefore exceed $1 billion. These expectations for 14 won't change. The outlook for the balance of the year is simple and straightforward. Comments will focus on our remaining core. The actual percentage rise in revenues and margins for Weatherford as a whole will be also influenced by timing of the non-core divestments. Upon divestment, the arithmetic is simple. The company's revenues will decline and margins rise. Again, what follows here is prognosis for the remaining company's core, Q2 to Q4. The U.S. and Eastern Hemisphere will carry the year's gains over 13. Both revenues and margins are expected to rise throughout the year. Both Eastern Hemisphere and U.S. will have strong years with improved financial results quarter after quarter. Although we model Eastern Hemisphere as having the strongest performance through Q4, I myself do not know which of the two will be on top. Latin America will be relatively flat at the operating income line until sometime in the second half, with the startup of contracts in Brazil, recovery in Colombia, and more gain in Argentina. Latin American revenues, operating income, and margins will close the year higher than in Q1, paving the way for 2015 with a combination of much stronger Argentina, Brazil, and Colombia, joined by resurgent Mexico. Taken in isolation, overall revenues of the core will rise year-on-year, this is 2013-14, by about 10%. Q1 on Q4 operating income margins will likely rise by about 400 basis points. Core operating income margins should close the year circa 19%, and they test 20%. Performance in Q3 and Q4 will pave the way for 2015 profitability. 2014 will be the first year of financial and operating turnaround. Won't be the last. We have three and only three objectives in mind: delever, de-risk, and step change profitability. 2014 will show material progression on all three. This is our direction, commitment, and focus. It will be driven. It will not change. With that, I will turn the call back to the operator of the Q&A session.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We ask that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up, then re-enter the queue for any additional questions that you may have. Our first question will come from the line of Jim Crandall with Cowen.
Thank you, and thanks for all the information. Bernard, I missed some of your comments there toward the end, right? I didn't get them, but what is your expectation now for run rate for operating margins by the end of the year, and how would that vary between the different geographies?
I think overall, this is now referring to the core. Let's assume that we're only talking about the core. The timing of the non-core is difficult to know. By Q4, the core overall should run a 19.19 or thereabouts operating margin. And my operating margin, so that we are clear on the numbers being used, are always before corporate and R&D. Corporate and R&D represents roughly 3% of revenues. Okay? Krishna may want to add to that.
Yes, thanks for that. Overall margins for the business, including non-core businesses, we are forecasting to reach between 16 and 17% in the second half of the year, which includes the 19% that for the core businesses that Bernard.
The comment I added in my, in the few words that I read, 19, there is a case to be made internally that both Darmish and I look at, which is the core should be around 19. It may test 20, but then again, we'll see.
And the revenue improvement Q1 to Q4, Bernard?
Sorry?
I said, yeah, and you also commented on, I think, the revenue improvement for the core businesses Q1 through Q4.
Actually, on that one, I just gave the year-on-year for the core, which is even simpler, which is the core should grow roughly at 10%, 13-14, the overall core, which is, reasonable, given what we have.
It seems, Bernard, that by the taking into account cost-cutting, your margin expectations, the increase in revenue, that it's reasonable to think you could be at a $2 a share run rate by the fourth quarter?
I'll let Krishna answer that.
I think we will be in good shape to get close to that. Yes, that our internal forecasts point towards that direction. Absolutely.
Great news. Okay, thank you very much, guys.
Thank you, Jim.
Your next question will come from the line of James West with Barclays.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, James.
First, Krishna, in terms of the divestiture program and where we stand now, obviously one sale or one announced sale, a second one probably coming soon. For the two businesses that you intend to divest of by the end of this year, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but part of the gating item in getting these assets up for sale was the completion of standalone financials for the businesses. Has that been done at this point? Have those been shared with potential buyers?
Well, we have not shared that, publicly, but, the carve-out process is ongoing for some of the businesses, principally the wellheads and the drilling fluids. They've already been carved out for businesses we are divesting. Is your question more about discontinued operations? Is that what you're asking here?
Well, I'm just asking, I think that to the two businesses, that the ones you just mentioned that you're divesting, that in order to line up the buyers, they really need just to see the financials from those operations through the carve-out process, I guess. And so I guess what you're saying is that that's already occurred.
Yes. I mean, obviously, we're showing a carved-out financial set of statements to potential buyers for the businesses that we're socializing, absolutely.
The other way to answer your question, James, is that remember there are four businesses altogether being sold. One is sold already, which is pipeline, now well testing. Then of course the other two you mentioned, which is wellhead and drilling fluids, which are smaller. In all four cases, the carve outs have been done ahead of time. The one
right.
that is, I think, still ongoing and will be ongoing for the balance of the year, together with the process of audit and so forth, will be the rig business. But that's a bigger animal and will be realistically will not be dealt with in whether it is a spin-off or an IPO or variation thereof, will not be dealt with until sometime early next year.
Okay. Fair enough. Understood. And then on the Latin American margins, it surprised at least my estimates to the upside significantly. I think probably others as well. It sounds like from Dharmesh's comments and Bernard, your comments as well that those margins should continue. I guess I was concerned about the winding down of the Venezuela or winding down with the lower Venezuelan operations, but it seems like that didn't have a material impact on margins. Was there anything? Am I missing something there in LATAM that drove a better quarter than we should have expected, or is this a good run rate going forward?
Well, I'll give you some thoughts, and Dharmesh may add to it. The biggest mover in Q1 was actually a drop in revenues coming from the largest operation we have in Latin America, which is Mexico. Revenue dropped by 30% in Q1 versus Q4. That 30%, in simple terms, you could assume it carried very little operating income. So revenue down, no operating income move, therefore margins up. Big factor. Second big factor is Argentina. Argentina has grown to where it is now the second operation in Latin America after Mexico, and it's hot on the trail in terms of size of Mexico. It overcame not only Venezuela, which has come down, obviously, for the reasons that you mentioned, but also it has, for us, overcome Brazil and Colombia in terms of size, and the margin in Argentina are very good. So that is the second factor. Thirdly, we did not have the headwind of negative contracts in Brazil, which some of our peers have. We're in different businesses. And so at the end of the day, the only headwinds we faced in Latin America was the drop-off in revenues in Mexico and the fact that Mexico is in a standstill all year. And then second, the self-imposed reduction of activity in Venezuela. But as I just told you, it was overcome by all the things that I described, and Dharmesh will add some further comments.
And James, the only other thing I would add to Bernard's comment is we have an extensive manufacturing footprint in Latin America, and we've been doing a lot of work on optimizing our manufacturing footprint, and that's also contributing because you don't have some negative overhang of having inefficient manufacturing.
Which is actually a cost-driven push on margins.
Right, got it. Okay, thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you, James.
Thank you, James.
Your next question will come from the line of Jim Wicklund with Credit Suisse.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Jim.
I don't mean to harp on Latin America, but were there any catch-up payments from Venezuela and Mexico or reversals from reserves in the quarter?
No. There was no. I wish, there was any catch-up payments from Venezuela. I'm afraid not. I think maybe, Krishna, you want to address the process ongoing with PDVSA. But the answer to your question is no, and you'll find the margins in Latin America will bop around where they are today throughout the year. And they probably end up a little bit higher towards the end of the year simply because of the startups and well construction contracts in Brazil and the fact that Colombia will turn in the second half of the year and that kind of stuff. So it's not a peak-to-valley syndrome at all. But when you want to comment on Venezuela?
And Krishna, while you do, and I'd love to get a catch-up on Venezuela, can you tell us what currency translation is being used and how that impacts everything?
So on Venezuela, we're still using, on the currency side, Jim, the official rate of 6.3, like our peers, because we don't have any, we don't intend to access any of the other avenues of exchange rate regimes that have been put in place by the Venezuelan government. But on progress with PDVSA, we're in active dialogue with our customer to engage in a constructive payment program, which will allow us to work on a more concrete footing with the customer going forward. This hasn't concluded yet, but the signs are quite encouraging.
Okay, and thank you, Krishna. And as my follow-up, I'll ask both of you gentlemen, what is the thing that you worry about most that could derail all this over the next 12 months, everything you're doing? What's the thing that you lose sleep over on a Tuesday night?
Well, I would say, Jim, if we were not public, we would not worry as much. What I mean by that is that everything has to work very, very well so that we keep both the credibility and the basically in what we're doing. And so that would be our biggest worry. If we were private, which I'm not suggesting we will be private, of course, but if we were private, I think what we're doing is so simple, and the drive to explain, to communicate what we're doing has been so intense with the organization, never mind Wall Street as the organization, that I think that when people are aligned, and this is an organization that can perform, the people really want the company to do well, it's purely a question of time. It's not a question of whether. Damish, you want to add to it?
Sure, Jim. A couple of things. I would say it's not, outside the U.S., it's no longer about having sufficient contracts in our pipeline. We have the work, we secured the work, and most of it is core products that we do very well every single day. So this is not exotic stuff. So we're not having to do any massive project integration or any of those things to deliver the revenue and the profitability we are targeting. The risk really is U.S. activity. Is really, does it stay on its current pace in terms of as strong as Q2 levels, let's say today, or does it taper down in Q4? The last 2 years, that's been an unknown event in terms of what happens in Q4. This year, it doesn't look likely, but you know the U.S. as well as I do. But if you take the U.S. activity out of the equation, you could have project startup delays, but there is nothing that significant, or no one project is that significant that would have a material movement one way or the other.
Perfect. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
And sorry, Jim, I'd like to add, of course, the ever-present geopolitical risk that exists, right? So this is the only thing out there which, can cause everybody.
So summarize, geopolitics, U.S., and the generic need for us to be reliable. You have now the triangle of worry.
Thank you, guys.
Your next question will come from the line of Ola Slor with Morgan Stanley.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It's very rare to see companies take out this kind of headcount and cost without having some kind of major impairment on execution capabilities. So could you talk a little bit about the 20 locations that you are reducing, the nature of this, how much of your headcount reduction is to do with these location reductions? And how do you feel confident that this isn't somehow impacting the ability of the core to execute?
Krishna, you want to address that?
Yes. Ola, you know, on the headcount reduction, we have clearly identified by name over 6,600 employees, and the execution to date has been very, very strong. Over 4,300 employees have already been intimated and are out of the company, which leaves another 2,300 to do. We have a week-by-week count of who's going to be intimated in which week, and by the end of the second quarter, the rest of the employees will be off our payroll. So we have a very high degree of confidence in the execution of the headcount reduction, which will give us significant savings. Now, on the locations closures, basically we're targeting locations which do not have any significant revenue attributes. They are locations which have, we've kind of been hanging on to them with a cost base in place, hoping for more work or trying to get more work, trying to bid ourselves into certain markets and with certain product lines. And, you know, what we're doing now is to shut those down, consolidate our bases, and focus our efforts in the right direction. So there will be some impact of write-downs, certainly, on the severance and on the closure costs, no question about that. But our margins will improve substantially because we eliminate losses. Dharmesh?
Sure. So one more comment I would make is majority of the cost cuts are in support positions. What we have done is that we've basically come up with a template structure for what we want a small country to look like, a medium country to look like, and a large country to look like. And we analyzed what support functions existed in those countries. Based upon the template, what is the headcount we needed? And then we identified, you know, the appropriate measures that need to be taken to get to the right support structure level. In many ways, you're not touching what I would call the revenue-generating aspect of your organization as part of the headcount organization, unless, like Krishna talked about here, if you happen to be exiting wireline in the country of Norway because you don't believe it has the right future in the short term, you may let go of the wireline people in Norway. But a lot of the focus has been around exiting the support structure. And in many ways, that is one of the reasons why we don't anticipate a very strong negative impact at all or any impact on the revenue and the ability to deliver the core products and services.
All right. I'll give you the last overall view, Oli, to add to what Krishna and Dharmesh said. So, you know, your point is well taken. What you're really saying is that this business of laying off so many people leaves scars and always does some collateral damage. I don't think any one of us is saying that is not true. I would also say this, the notion that one can at the same time grow the core and so forth has to come across as difficult, because what we're really saying is that we're going to retreat and attack at the same time. So I would say they were very clear on that. I think the first thing is the reason why we wanted the curtailment to happen with massive internal communication, and I really mean massive, Oli, and fast, is precisely to get the retreat bit out of the way so we could move in the next phase. This is number one. Number two, as Dharmesh has identified, most of the position, and I mean no disrespect to the positions concerned, but most of the positions being curtailed that will be described as redundant layers that grew particularly in the very high aggressive growth years, and they, if anything, they probably were an obstacle to, you know, the good functioning of operations. And so I think you have more of an unleashed operation rather than a constrained operation. With respect to the to the locations, look, we have rough numbers, over 1,100 locations. We're talking about reducing 50. So you do the math. It is just not. I mean, I'm using simplistic numbers here. We're talking about 4% reduction. This is not a big number. And, you know, by and large, the candidates for shutdown have not been, to my knowledge, ever mandated from Houston or Geneva. No. The logic of the turnaround, and that's going to be my last point, Oli, the whole notion of turnaround. The logic of the turnaround made it compelling for the regions to identify within their midst a number of locations and business propositions that they knew full well were not sensible. were never sensible. They were overly aggressive. And so really the list and the rationale, if anything, has been held back, as we didn't want to take too much risk at the Houston and Geneva level. So lastly, remember what Weatherford is. Step back for a minute. After all these years of growth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and probably overly successful, went through some very hard times. The very hard times not only felt by the shareholders, they were also felt by the entire organization. An organization that has stood by Weatherford all these years also understands that now we have to, now that much of it is behind us, what caused the ailments behind us, now we must perform. The people that have stayed understand the need for a turnaround. And so the logic of what we're doing and the fact that we're in a hurry to do it well is completely understood. And so they have great endorsement on the part of the organization for what we're doing. This is not a punishing mandate. It is actually something that the organization almost welcomes because it is what needs to get done. Sorry for the long answer.
Nice, very comprehensive, and thanks, Jens, for helping shed some light on what must be, after all, a pretty difficult process. So I'll hand it back.
Your next question will come from the line of Bill Herbert with Simmons & Company.
Thanks, good morning. Do you guys have handy your core margins by subsegment, and then also contemplating your 19% to 20% exit rate margin, what margin does that imply for each of the core subsegments? So where are we today with regard to the subsegments? Where do we get to?
Krishna, why don't you give the margins, if you can, by core segments for Q1?
So Bill, overall margins for the core, all the core segments, as we said, was 15.1%.
Got it.
Our production margin was 17.4% for Q1. Formation evaluation was quite low in Q1 because of some headwinds we had in a few countries, 5.5%.
Okay.
Well construction was 23.8%. Completions was 23.6%. And stimulation continued to be negative at minus 3.6%. That gives you overall 3.1. Now, as we go forward, we expect overall core margins to grow nicely. We will maintain our own on well construction and completions, in fact, grow them marginally. Production will be pretty solid. Stimulation margins will turn around, obviously with the market conditions and the continuous repair we're doing on the businesses going into the second, third, and fourth quarters. And formation evaluation will also improve as we go forward to reach the 19% kind of margin.
So let me put it in perspective for you, Bill.
Yeah.
Although I think Krishna is reluctant to give you our own internal forecast on future margins, which I can understand, although it is all modeled. The biggest movers is obviously well construction and completion and production have done well, will continue to do well, and there are some improvements that are planned. They're not very high, the improvements. The deltas are very high. The biggest delta comes in formation evaluation. And then of course, because stimulation is still negative, it turns positive, and there's also a delta.
Okay. Stimulation, and also Bill, stimulation had the biggest impact of the weather, both Russia and U.S.
So Q1 is particularly
low from a stimulation perspective because of the weather.
But at the same time, also for that, he understands that we're not, and I think Bill understands this, we're not Halliburton, and we're not a pressure pumping company. It is not revenue-wise the biggest mover, I know Bill understands that.
No, right, got that. Thanks very much. And then more of a conceptual question going forward here. In a world in which, you're generating, very attractive margins on your best core businesses, you expect to witness, I think, plausible and well-supported improvement in your underperforming core businesses, and thus an overall margin which is going to be pretty darn impressive. And in a world in which sort of global E&P CapEx is witnessing sort of methodical but hardly cathartic growth, walk us through the tension between trying to realize growth and preserving your normalized margins going forward.
Very fair question. So we'll ignore the macro of whether what the IOCs are doing is tenable from a supply of hydrocarbon standpoint. I'm referring to the liquid segment, not the gas segment, which is a different story. So set that aside. This is a topic for a different day. I think that we're very, very aware that we cannot have too high an expectation of growth internally here because of the underlying market. What we get some comfort in is a function of two things. Three things, really. And one is the fact that we have in our cause leadership in segments of the business which are very specific, which are not ones that Wall Street is particularly focused in, and they're not very large segments of the industry, but still ones in which we excel, and for reasons that have to do with the situations of reservoirs around the world, are going to do quite well from a secular standpoint. This, for example, this business of well integrity, this business of mature field plays, in general, will see a more generous allocation of capital than it did in the past as a percentage of the pie. This is one issue. The second is, again, remember who you're speaking with. We have, with the exception of North America, we have in the rest of the world, how would you characterize our market penetration? It's rather low. We have a very low share of the underlying pie. In fact, by any measurement you take analytically, you'll find that, roughly speaking, we are where we are in North America versus where we are internationally, globally, there are differences. Huh? We're about one-third in the rest of the world where we are as a participation of the E&P pie than we are in North America. Now, there is no reason for that fundamentally. Yeah, there are differences whether you deal with Brazil or whether you deal with a Saudi, whether you deal with a Russia. I'm clear. But overall, Bill, there is no reason why we only have a third internationally of what we have in North America in terms of share participation. That doesn't mean at all we are on some sort of crusade to gain share and everything else. It just means that we have more headroom. If you add to that my comment, which I don't want to detail too much for competitive reasons, a lot of the segments that we're in, not all, but a lot of segments we're in, we are specialists or we are, you know, sort of masters of our destiny in segments where we're pretty much on our own versus large competitors. And this is not an accident. And so I would put forth to you that your point is absolutely correct, and we are moderating our views of what we should be striving to get done. You don't hear us talk about 20% per annum and that sort of stuff anymore. We're much more reasonable. We also don't want to go down the road of doing things too aggressively with poor quality and poor capital efficiency. Completely clear on this. At the same time, understand that one of the virtues of being smaller, one of the virtues of being focused, one of the virtues of having infrastructure is that actually it's a little bit easier for us to grow than other people.
Yep. All fair points. Thanks very much.
Sure. Your next question will come from the line of Byron Pope with Tudor Pickering Holt.
Good morning. Bernard, you all mentioned that the Middle East, North Africa, Asia-Pacific growth will be led by the Gulf countries. Just was wondering if you could share a little bit about which geomarkets within that region you think drive the growth. I mean, it seems to be a lot of excitement about Saudi, so wondering if you could size for us which of those geomarkets will be most impactful to your growth over the next couple of years.
It's Byron, it's an easy question, but I'll try to make it a bit more comprehensive of an answer. The kingdom is obviously the place to quote Saudi Arabia. Why? Not only because the intense work on and around maintaining the oil production capacity from the continued development of their excellent reservoirs, which are showing age. This is one set of issue. The other set of issue is the development of unconventional shale gas resources in the northwest part of the country, which is a second development in Saudi Arabia. Combine both, there's planned and executed large increases in drilling this year and next year. This is the biggest play by far in terms of delta This is number one. I do not want to also forget, in talking about Saudi Arabia, the other two large markets, even now, and add a third one, which is Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, and even Oman. All three of them, for their own idiosyncratic reasons, have some very serious expansion plans. The numbers, you know, in isolation, because of the size of their respective markets, are not as large in isolation as Saudi, but collectively they are. So that's the other mover. And I think you end up with a tale of two cities when you look at the Gulf Coast, which is, on the one hand, you have the markets I just described, where I think competitive intensity is high, but growth is also promising. The quality of business is very high in terms of the types of technological requirements, operationally requirements, but at the same time, margins are good, and it's really quite stable. It's reliable as anything can be in our industry. Then you have the other markets, which I think are more difficult, simply because of the nature of the market, and there will be southern Iraq. And so it is understandable that certain oil field service companies, of which Weatherford is one, choose to de-emphasize southern Iraq and then, on the contrary, emphasize the other ones, which have really an attractive outlook, always subject to geopolitical risk, attractive outlook, and reliable, Myron, through the end of next year, possibly the following, possibly into 16. These things take time.
Thank you.
I think it's one last question, and then we'll have to close the call because we're a little bit above the hour.
Our final question will come from the line of Robin Shoemaker with Citi.
Thanks. Bernard, maybe Dharmesh, I wanted to ask if you could give us an update on artificial lift and that as a product line in terms of growth and margins. We've been hearing a lot on recent conference calls about some solutions that other companies have come up with for low productivity wells, which clearly is one of your core areas. And so I wonder if you could comment on that, and also if there's any changes in the business since the ownership of one of your largest competitors in rod lift has changed hands.
All right. So I think one of the common themes we are hearing and everybody's talking about is, you know, the one form of artificial lift we are not in, which is ESPs, and how ESPs are being used for the shale wells. I mean, simply put, if you look at the efficiency of what's been publicized and what's publicly available, the efficiencies of that system are 20% at 50 barrels a day, you know, running all the way up to 40% at something else. And the rod lift system sits at 60% efficiency. If you look at the cost of changing an ESP, the fact that the pump is fundamental downhole, the fact that the world's production changes from 1,000 barrels a day to 20 barrels a day over a span of a year, and the number of times you'd have to change the pumps out and the cost of the electrical cost required, there are many, many factors that make it, you know, highly unlikely that you would have a large-scale replacement of RRPs with ESPs going on. And I will say for every one customer that you talk about doing something like that, we also have several customers in our backlog of artificial lift in the U.S. where they're moving away from ESPs and moving to RRPs. So this battle of, you know, ESPs, is it a new twist on ESP? Is it a new twist on RRP? I think that battle will rage on and time will decide. But if you look at the fundamentals of what ESPs are all about, you look at the fundamental economics of running large-scale wells, you look at the workover and the well servicing costs, it's hard to define in my mind what really the basic science tells you about what is the right thing from a business perspective, from an artificial lift perspective.
A closing comment, and Robin, this is a fun question because this is the very first business that was developed 27 years ago in this company. What is wonderful about ESPs is that they have a motor downhole because that gives them essentially a tremendous, tremendous power to move fluids. What is terrible about ESPs is they have a motor downhole because it's vulnerable, breaks. I will just say this. I think it is to a degree endearing to find now the humble field of artificial lift getting so much press after all these years. So, you know, in a way, it makes me happy. We take the competitive pressures certainly from GE very seriously because we should. because it is a very, very good company, and obviously, and a very large company, etc. So we take it very seriously. It's, we should assume that this is something that will make all of us more competitive. Respect to the replacement of this form of pump by that form of pump. Time will tell. I think a smaller diameter ESP in the horizontal section of a shale well is not a bad idea. A smaller diameter ESP in a horizontal section of a shale well has challenging economics. And what I've just told you has been true, is true, will be true. Having said this, there will be horses for courses. There will be applications where it does well. And I wish the company that developed it, you know, good fortune in getting that product out to market. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Robin. With that, I think we'll close the call because we're a little bit over the hour. Thank you, everyone, for your time.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for joining, and you may now disconnect.